This is Haystack Help Radio on KLZ 560. Haystack Help Radio is powered by HaystackHelp.com. Finding help can be like finding a needle in a haystack, but with HaystackHelp.com, finding the needle just got easier. Now, Haystack Help Radio with Scott Watley on KLZ 560.
Good afternoon and welcome to Haystack Help Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Scott Watley and we appreciate you being with us. Be sure and check out our website, haystackhelp.com. There you'll find a lot of great companies to do business with, and we appreciate you checking that out. We've got a help box right there on our homepage, and our helpline is always open, 303-333-HELP, 303-333-4357. Today it's the Legal Hour with our good friend Kevin Flesh, Flesh and Beck Law. You can check out that website, fleshlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H lawfirm.com. Kevin's number, I always give this out a lot of times during the show. Put it in your phone. You never know when you may need it, 303-806-8886. Kevin, how are you, sir?
I'm great, Scott. Beautiful, beautiful day just before
the... It is, man. All the holidays start kicking in, but man, it's beautiful. Look over and see some snow on the mountains.
Right. It's good. It's good to have that. It's nice that a bunch of ski resorts opening early, and hopefully we'll have this. You know, this fall winter season this year reminds me a lot of the mid '90s when I first moved out here. It seems like we had a couple of years where we had a lot of snow early, and it just kept snowing all season. So I'm hoping that's what it is this year too.
I know we can always use that, and I think all the fires are doing pretty good here. But man, California,
it's a mess.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean that's. Fires are devastating, but I've never seen footage like I've seen recently in there.
Paradise, the road in, road out
thing. People in cars, dude. I mean, the cars are melting.
Yeah.
I mean, it was horrible.
I know it must have been people are trying to make a decision what's best for them, but I can't imagine you see the fire roaring down on you and you're in your car. I would have gotten out, but maybe you can't. Maybe they just couldn't.
Yeah,
the fire was going so fast. I don't know. Unbelievable, though, all of that footage. And heart goes out to all those folks.
Sure, wow.
And anyone else that's in harm's way. But fires, it's a bad deal.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, another bad deal and something that can put a damper on your holidays is what we're going to talk about today. And that is DUIs. And it is something where usually at the end of every year they talk about how many people, unfortunately, you know, got a DUI. And then, of course, lives that were lost and lives that were changed and maybe just horrific injuries. And Kevin, I think we ought to kick it off with the right word of prevention because, I mean, just
that's
like most
part.
Things in traffic, they are all preventable.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And this one in particular, especially in the metro area, because we have so many opportunities to have. First of all, you need a plan, right? We always talk about that. Whenever we start talking about this topic, I mean, obviously we do a bunch of this work and we have a lot of people that make mistakes in drinking and driving after they're under the influence of something. But the biggest thing is to have a plan so that you don't have to worry about that. And, you know, get the apps on your phone for the different driving services, Lyft, Uber, whatever. Get the ability to just have some money if you don't have those apps so that you can get a taxi. Or just have a plan at the beginning of the night if you know you're going to be drinking that you do something so that you don't get behind the wheel. Mm-hmm. If you're one of those individuals, and I've had these clients where you have a few drinks and then you think you're bulletproof, make sure that you don't have your keys to your car.
Right.
I mean, because as much as we enjoy doing this work for people and we add value and all of those sorts of things that we talk about, I'd rather not have the phone calls for the DUIs because it is all preventable.
Sure.
There's nothing. It's not against the law to drink. It's not against the law anymore to smoke marijuana. What the issue is getting behind the wheel of a car.
Right?
I mean, because that's the criminal act that causes people problems, and it's all preventable.
Right.
There is never a time in a metropolitan area like we have where it's that much of an emergency that you have to get in behind the car and drive away. There just isn't.
Mm-hmm. And when you look, and I mean, you could probably tell me better on this, but when you meet with people, I would bet you 75% of your people are within 5-10 miles of their house. I mean, a lot of them go to neighborhood places near their home, whatever. So it doesn't matter. Like, hey, it's only an 8-minute drive to my house.
That makes no difference.
A lot can go wrong in 8 minutes.
I got a case that I took on yesterday that he was 150 yards from his apartment. He basically drove across a parking lot from the bar to a parking spot in his apartment building. The problem was he was talking to police officers at the bar because there had been an assault. And then he walks outside, gets in his car. The police watch him do it, and they allow him to drive across the parking lot. They then arrest him there for DUI. And there is an example of you'd think, just don't get in your car, right? But, I mean, those are the things that people have to think about and have a plan about, you know what? If I'm going to be having more than one small beer or one small cocktail with dinner, you have to have a plan. Mm-hmm. Because it's not... Remember, we've got laws relating to the amount of alcohol that's in your system for the actual consumption of that. It's not against the law to have one drink and drive. That's that. But the point is if you can stop yourself, that's fine. But most people can't. So have a plan.
Right.
And otherwise, you're talking to me or you're talking about the things that we're going to talk about the rest of the hour of trying to figure out how to get your life back together.
Absolutely. And when you look at the cost of an Uber ride or different things...
Yes.
Pretty good deal for Uber.
Very, very good deal. I am a very expensive Uber driver.
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah, that's no...
Because, I mean, you're looking probably with everything, you know, your court cost, all the different things, maybe the interlock device, and we'll get into that a little bit. But, I mean, you could approach 10 grand pretty quick.
Very quickly. I think most people, when they get done, they often tell me that that's... It's $7,500 to $10,000. When you consider the classes you have to take, the amount of work that you lose, the fact that you've just got a bunch of things you need to do to get yourself righted in the sense of having to do with the things for probation. If you're convicted of the crime, then you have probation. They have supervision fees, which are $50 a month. It could be a year or two. You know, that's $600 or $1,200 a month right there. The other court costs are not cheap either. You know, an alcohol assessment normally costs you between $250 and $350. That's just for the court to decide which classes you need to take, the classes themselves. And then the courts a lot of times will say, well, I won't fine you because we've got all these costs. But they put on all of these different costs that they have that they characterize as costs and not fine. But, it's the traumatic brain injury fund. It's the persistent drunk driver fund. They have all of these different funds now within the state to pay for things relating to drunk driving in particular that aren't really characterized as fines, but mm-hmm. they're costs, and it's still the same money. You still have to pay it. So, and those are normally somewhere between, depending upon the courthouse, anywhere between $750 and $1,000. So those are just costs to get you through the process of getting out of court that day for relating to the court and what it expects you to do before you have supervision fees, before you have any classes that you have to take. Interlock, like you said, that's a DMV process. Level 2 alcohol education. There's just a bunch of things that you have to do, along with you lose your driving privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got to learn about all of the things that we first talked about.
Right.
So it's and the attorney fees and all of the, I mean, we're not inexpensive either. So, sure. It's really a situation, especially when it's completely something you can control, mm-hmm. that you need to do that.
Right. And we talk about cost. I mean, of course, you talk about the dollars, but then you talk about going to these classes, sitting there. I mean, that's your time, too, and all. And then how do you get there?
Right.
I mean,
right.
We can talk about all the DMV process.
Yes.
But then you look at, you know, hey, could it cost you a job and what you do?
Yeah. If you have a CDL,
yeah.
You know, if you need that CDL license, an alcohol-related offense, you lose your CDL and there's no ability to have it for at least a year on the first offense. There's just a lot of things that are impacted.
Insurance rates.
Those go up as well. Absolutely. You have to have an SR-22, which is proof of insurance that you provide to the state of Colorado whenever that SR-22 comes into play. They don't generally charge an additional amount for the SR-22, but obviously if you need it, the insurance company is going to look into why that proof of insurance is needed and increase your rates.
Right.
It's just a part of the process.
Kevin Flesh is with us. We will open up our phone lines. If you've got any kind of legal question, we will take your calls, 303-477-5600. And, well, when you look at the whole process of everything, it all starts with, you look in that rearview mirror and you see those lights,
yeah.
And your heart starts beating, and then you're going like, oh, no, what now? And so many times, if you've been drinking, you tend to talk too much.
Right. So, yeah, so this is always the question at parties when I'm talking to people and people learn that we do this sort of work. They say, what do I do when exactly that? You've not followed through with your plan. You're now...
plan B.
Right. Plan B is now you driving home and you see the lights come on and you're being pulled over. The first thing that people have to realize is that when you're being pulled over, and especially if it's late at night, officers who work late at night are generally the better officers in determining whether or not there's alcohol involved in the stop. They get specifically trained to look at certain indicators, and some of them are really good at just looking at how you're driving. So if you're weaving all over the road, that's going to be an indication that you may be impaired. Police officers have to have a reasonable suspicion to pull you over. So they can't just pull you over just because they like your car, or they have to have a legal reason that you've done something wrong to pull you over. So, but late at night, you know, those reasons can be pretty murky. The easy ones are the people that are doing something against the law. They haven't used their blinker. They're swerving in the roadway. They hit a curb. You've blown a tire and you're just driving on the rim. You know, I've had that case.
Right.
You know, and or you're speeding. Mm-hmm. You're doing some sort of traffic infraction that they clearly can just pull you over for that.
Right.
And so once they turn on their lights, a lot of times there's dash cams that will start recording what's going on. And most of the jurisdictions now in the metro area have those dash cams. So from the moment that they turn on their lights, they're gathering evidence against you to determine whether or not there's an issue relating to being under the influence. And any time that you're pulled over after, let's say, 10 o'clock at night, they're thinking that they've got just the regular traffic offense plus something else. And so you have to think about what you're doing real clearly about getting over and pulling over and making sure that that seems normal if you're under the influence, and that you then wait for the officer to come up. We always have those card holders here at the radio station, and we give them out quite often. You want to have your driver's license and registration ready to go.
And I should say, and that, I think that's where a lot of people mess up, is they start digging in their glove box.
Right.
They're nervous.
Yes.
They're drunk.
They're drunk, yeah.
And they can't find the piece of paper. And automatically that tells that officer, this person's disheveled. They're not organized. And if you hand them all that, like I say, and this really neat thing that you have,
right.
That's going to make you seem like, hey, I got stuff together.
That's right.
Not give them even more time to evaluate the situation.
You don't want to have them next to your door any more than they need to be. And so you want to have that stuff put together. You want to have your hands on top of the steering wheel so that they see that you're not rummaging around for a handgun or anything else. You want that officer to be feeling very comfortable about where they're at. Give them the information and move on. The majority of the reports that I get with officers that believe someone's impaired by alcohol or drugs is that you're not organized and you're fumbling around. It looks like you don't know what you're doing. You hand them your driver's license, which turns out to be a credit card versus a driver's license. So they keep track of all of that stuff to indicate that there's some sort of impairment. So,
and I want to bring that up because not only with all the cameras today too, but you've mentioned before, even on the back of speeding citation, they'll make little notes of, hey, this driver was extremely courteous, whatever.
Right.
Or, you know what, they were very disrespectful to us. So.
Yeah, and you never want to start berating an officer, obviously, in any situation. And that certainly isn't in the event that you've had alcohol in your system. You don't want to start really making any negative comments towards the officer. Because anytime, the other thing you want to do is you want to keep, obviously, your voice down. You don't want to speak as little as possible because that'll give off some sort of smell, potentially. And that's another indication of impairment. Mm-hmm. So that's the beginning part of the stop.
And we can, right. When we come back, we'll talk about it, okay? The million-dollar question. Where have you been tonight, or have you been drinking?
Right.
What comes next? It's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesch. We'll be right back.
Rates are going up. How do you protect your home if times get tough again? While we don't expect a repeat, there may be challenges. Learn how to become mortgage safe. Does your current mortgage make your payment for you if you can't? Do they allow you to access your equity for that unexpected emergency? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Thousands have learned how to become mortgage safe by not continuing to pay compound interest. That's interest on interest. Why continue to pay over 70% of what you borrow back to the bank in excessive interest? Take AIM, Affordable Interest Mortgage, 720-895-0500. Own your home faster, pay simple interest, and save thousands while paying principal first. Everything I mentioned can be done with one loan. With home value going up, now is the time to become mortgage safe. Protect your home and your family. Take AIM, your locally owned and operated broker since 2001. Afford affordable interest mortgage. 720-895-0500. NMLS 298191, regulated by DORA, equal credit lender.
Let me tell you about one of my favorite stores, The Outdoorsman's Attic, a consignment store for all of your adventure outdoor gear. Hunting, fishing, camping, kayaks, live bait, survival gear, backpacks, sleeping bags, firearms, and ammo. Save 20, 30, 40, and even 50% on new and pre-owned items at The Outdoorsman's Attic. Mention Sportsman of Colorado and save up to 20% on your purchase. This offer excludes firearms and ammo. Never pay retail again. Big savings and friendly service is what you'll find at The Outdoorsman's Attic. Located at 2650 West Hamden Avenue in Sheridan. 303-781-3626. That's 303-781-3626. Check them out, outdoorsmansattic.com.
What could you do with an extra $500, $1,000, or even $1,500 per month? How would that change things for you? Would you buy a new car, pay off bills, or just feel a bit more secure about your retirement? What if I told you there's a way to make your dreams a reality? I'm talking about trading and investing in the market. Now, before you say, oh, that's not for me, just hear me out. I want to invite you to a half-day trading course so you can check this out. I promise you, you'll go away smarter than when you came in. We here at Online Trading Academy sponsor this, and we'll even send you home with a free home study video guide. Your money's doing nothing for you in a CD or mutual fund. Learn how to profit when the market's up or down. Call us now while seats are still available at 303-325-2776. Use offer code RADIO50. 303-325-2776. That's 303-325-2776.
Rush to Reason with John Rush, weekdays from 3 to 7 on KLZ 560.
Welcome back. You're listening to Haystack Help Radio. If you're just joining us, my name is Scott Watley. We appreciate you being with us. Kevin Flesh is with us. Flesh and Beck Law, fleshlawfirm.com. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. I always suggest you put that in your phone so you've got it right at your fingertips whenever you have a legal question. And Kevin is with us every other Thursday all throughout this year and next year. And so we will continue to help bring you some good legal advice here on our Legal Hour. Talking about a tough subject today that's affected many of us or many of our friends. And if you're just joining us, we did talk about prevention, first of all, and having a plan, talked about the cost of this and insurance rates, you know, could cost you your job, a lot of different things. But now we're kind of going through the process. And so, Kevin, you see the lights, officer walks up and rolls down your window and says, you know, how you doing tonight? Where have you been? And
right.
Or have you been drinking?
Right.
What next?
Yeah. So when we drive on public roadways in Colorado, we consent to having a chemical test done in the event that an officer asks us to do one. And what those chemical tests are generally are either a breath test or a blood test. And the idea with this process is, though, that first, we talked the last segment about the fact that the officer has to have reasonable suspicion to pull you over. So they have to have a legal reason to pull you over that they believe you've committed a crime or a safety concern or something else. Mm-hmm. And those sorts of stops fall into two different categories. One is related to a violation of the law. The second portion would be a consensual stop. In other words, you do need help, and they're there to help you for a safety reason. You know, you have a bad, your car is not running, and they pull over just to make sure you're okay. Or, you know, there's a crime that was being committed, and you somehow were the victim of that crime, and they have contact with you for that. Those are all consensual contacts, and that consensual contact can still lead to an arrest. The important thing that you have to remember is that a police officer has a job to do, which is obviously fight crime and make sure that they keep people safe. But when you're having a contact with them that doesn't seem to be consensual and it seems to be related to a violation of the law, then you're in sort of an adversarial relationship. And you have constitutional rights that you don't have to answer questions that you don't want to and that you think may incriminate you, mm-hmm. right? That's the whole idea of the Fifth Amendment to our federal constitution, and the state constitution has a similar subsection. And so at any rate, so the idea when you have an officer that comes to your door, the thing that you have to do is you have to provide an ID, you have to identify yourself, and you have to probably provide them insurance at some point if they ask for it. Beyond that, you don't have to answer their questions. And so if an officer comes up to you and says, hey, where have you been tonight? That's not a question you have to answer. And you can do it in a really not very nice way, an argumentative way, which will cause probably more problems. But the way that I would suggest you do it is you say to the officer, I'm not answering that question. I'm sorry. I don't have to constitutionally, and I don't intend to. Their next question is, have you had anything to drink tonight? Which indicates to you probably that they smell alcohol and that they think something is going on. And again, you don't have to answer that question. I certainly wouldn't answer the question no when you've had alcohol, because then it looks like you're not being honest with the officer. Because at that point, they're trying
to... You don't have to get into how many
correct.
Or all that.
You don't want to. And no one... I've never seen anyone talk themselves out of a DUI after saying they've had alcohol. Just doesn't happen. The officers, that's one of the indicia. If you admit to drinking, then their guard is up. They're now going to be looking for other things to indicate that you're impaired. And so as soon as you answer that question, yes, and normally it's, I've had one or I've had two. Well, you've admitted to alcohol, so all bets are off relating to the fact that you're going to be released at this point without doing voluntary roadside maneuvers and without them being completely satisfied that you are not impaired. But you're sitting on the side of the road for another hour to figure out whether or not something's going on. And the idea with the officer, once they pull you over like that, the idea is they're trying to get information to determine whether or not they have probable cause to arrest you. Because that's the next stop. That's the next stop in their investigation. So okay, so they've got reasonable suspicion to pull you over. They have a reason because they think that you've committed some sort of violation of the law. The next is, oh, I smell alcohol in the car. Who else is in the car? Does it seem like the driver is impaired? They start asking you questions. A lot of times, people answer those questions because they get nervous. They think they have to. You don't have to. All right. So then the next thing is the officer is going to see whether or not, based upon how you're doing with giving them the information that they're asking for, whether or not it seems that you're impaired. Again, another test of whether or not they think they need to pull you out of the vehicle for voluntary roadside maneuvers. They'll tell you every time, voluntary roadside maneuvers. And every time I talked with someone in my office, they ask me, did I have to do those? And the answer is no. And I advise people never to do the voluntary roadside maneuvers. If the officer believes they have probable cause before you get out of the car to arrest you, then they can arrest you. Most of the time they don't. So once you do those voluntary roadside maneuvers, you're probably going to prove to them that they need to arrest you. And they're going to give you then, you're going to give them evidence that will help them in pursuing a conviction later. So that's why I say never do them. And if you don't, then you put the officer in a position where they have to decide on that spot whether or not they have enough to arrest you. Because if you do the voluntary roadside maneuvers, and let's say it's a one-leg stand, and they want you to stand with one leg off the ground for 10 seconds, and you do it for four, and you're swaying around, and you're using your arms for balance, that indicates to them and to a jury that you're impaired. And so if you don't do it, you're not giving them that evidence. All right, so if you don't do the roadside maneuvers, they then have to make a decision. Do I arrest the person and then ask them to do the express consent? They have to explain to you that you have to do a chemical test, and then you go through that process. If you do take the tests, then they get to use all of those tests against you later. And so sometimes people, this is what I see 20% of the time. The officer will say, do you want to take the voluntary roadside maneuvers? Yes, I'll do that. All right, so you get out, and they'll go halfway through the test, and the person will say, volunteering the information, I'm too drunk to do that. Right? I mean, you've got to, and I understand people in that situation probably are ultra nervous at that point. They're embarrassed by the situation they're in. But the idea is that you just don't want to be making any statements. And if you're doing the voluntary roadside maneuvers and you think that you're going to get through them, try them when you're completely sober. And I'm happy to tell you what those roadside maneuvers are normally. They're basically walking a line, heel to toe, 9 steps, turning around, coming back, 9 steps. And you try to explain that to someone when they're completely sober and have them do it. Half the time, they won't, if they're older in particular, they won't be balanced enough to do it. Mm-hmm. Because you start looking, oh, the other thing is they'll want you not looking at your feet, but looking straight ahead. And you'd be surprised by the number of people that just can't do them as when you know they're completely sober.
Yeah, right.
The one leg stand, again, a lot of people have trouble with that. Now, the nystagmus test, that test is basically administered, and it's basically what you have to do is you have to look at a light or a pen in front of you, and they use their light to see if your eyes voluntarily jitter at two different points, at 45 degrees and the other deviation.
And they don't want you moving your head, just following with your eyes.
Correct. And what they're looking for is for your eyeball essentially to jitter involuntarily. And the jittering happens in two situations. One, where you've consumed alcohol, or two, where you have a closed head injury. And so those sorts of tests can be used to determine, hey, again, I have probable cause. I have more than just a hunch that you've consumed alcohol. So again, if you're doing the voluntary roadside maneuvers, told you not to, but if you're doing them, never do the nystagmus test, because it's one of those things that's very subjective mm-hmm. on the officer's part, and you have no idea what they actually saw. They checked some boxes. Yes, there was nystagmus at different points, but you have no way of refuting it. A lot of times now with the dash cams and the body cams, the officer will actually be taping you do the other physical things. And sometimes the officer's report will be you did this poorly or that poorly, and we'll actually get the video of how you did it, and it actually doesn't look bad. I've had a couple of trials that I've won on the basis that the video didn't really show that you're impaired. Mm-hmm. The officer's report did, but a jury looking at it themselves says, well, the physicality of what they were doing
right.
doesn't indicate impairment. And so those are the sorts of things you have to think about. But there's so many things going on in your head when you're got a police officer next to your door, the best thing is just not to do them at all. Make the officer make the call whether they want you to do some sort of test, breath or blood. Now, relating to that test, you can refuse. And, of course, what I normally see is folks that are refusing are people that have multiple DUIs because they've been through the system before, and their position is that the least amount of evidence that they give the prosecution, the better off they are. The trouble with that sometimes is that they don't follow all the way through. So they may say, yes, I've had a beer or two. They don't do the voluntary roadside maneuvers, and they don't do the breath or blood test. But then there's video evidence of them getting out of the car and barely being able to stand. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you make a decision to refuse, you've got to be certain that there's no evidence of any impairment, because the stakes are so stacked against you at that point. Jurors are going to say, well, why did you refuse? You know, what was the reason that you refused that test if you weren't under the influence? I mean, that's where people
sure.
generally go.
Sure.
And there'll be an instruction by the court that'll actually say the refusal can be used against you. This particular issue has not been litigated, but I think it should be up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We have the right to not incriminate ourselves in every other situation in a criminal prosecution, except for this situation where a refusal can be used against you. You would think that the lack of a response from yourself in a criminal prosecution, they couldn't say, look, you wouldn't give us this information, so it's got to be presumed that you're guilty. Well, in any other type of case except a DUI, they can't use that sort of argument. But in DUIs, they can. Because they say, well, if you really were legal, then you just give a test and it would be done. That's the whole idea, and there's a jury instruction. So the other problem with refusals is that you lose your driving privilege for a long period of time. On a first offense, you lose it for a year. Now, you can get an interlock device after 60 days, but you have to have that interlock device in your vehicle then for 2 years. So there's real ramifications.
On the first time.
First time. Yeah. And so we're just talking about what you do then when you're asked to do a test. Mm-hmm. I recommend to people that you take a blood test. And the reason that I recommend the blood test is because, number one, they have to do two things. They first have to get a phlebotomist or someone that's licensed or at least trained to take blood from you.
Yeah. Right? At least I want somebody trained
right.
to do that.
I mean, the State Patrol right. officer can't right. show up with a needle and start taking blood from you. So
right.
the aspect of just going out and getting that person to show up and doing all of those sorts of things, there can be problems with that process. And then secondarily, they have to do two vials of blood. So those two vials of blood, one goes to the state to get it tested for the prosecution's purpose. The other vial is kept so that your defense lawyer, we have blood retested all the time to make sure that the state results are accurate.
Hmm.
And then there are just so many things that happen with the foundational purposes of that blood and the results of those blood tests at trial. It's much more difficult for a prosecutor to get all of that information in front of a jury. And so that's why I always recommend people doing blood.
Right.
And the Intoxilizer 9000 for the breath test, there's no secondary retesting or anything else. You're sort of left with a certification for the machine, the officer being certified. You have no idea whether the results are really accurate. And you can try to make that argument to a jury, but it's much better when you have a retest with blood and you see different results and you have two different experts coming in to talk about it.
Sure.
So that's why we always recommend blood.
Let's go to the phones real quick before our break. We've got Mike. Mike, you're on Haystack Help Radio, the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesh. How are you?
How you doing there, sir?
We're doing great, bud. Thanks.
I was told by a friend of mine in law enforcement that the roadside sobriety test, the walking foot-to-foot and all,
yeah,
that test was originally set up for Air Force fighter pilots who were in top-notch shape. So how can they use that to the average Joe?
Yeah, I would agree with you. Well, because the public doesn't... A lot of times in our jury selection and just argument to the jury, that's exactly what we talk about is... You know, the jurors go back and try to do these things sober to determine whether or not you could do them. And is it a fair test to be done to prove probable cause to have you take another test? But you're absolutely correct. But that's why I say they're voluntary. So you just don't do them.
Okay. I heard if you don't volunteer or refuse at all, that they just automatically take your license.
No. See, that's... You're talking about the express consent, and that's the chemical test that has to be taken after they've taken you into custody and they've arrested you. They've given you the advisement. You now have to take a breath or blood test. That's the second step. The first step is the voluntary roadside maneuvers to determine whether they have probable cause. And so a lot of people get that confused. You don't have to ever do those voluntary roadside maneuvers. It's after they arrest you and after they say, okay, I'm wanting you to take a chemical test of your breath or blood. That's the step in which if you refuse, you lose your driver's license.
Right. Okay. I had a guy that I worked with that got a DUI, and they gave him a blood test of about an hour and 7 minutes after the fact of being arrested.
Yes.
And they threw it out of court because they supposedly, from what I've heard, this is just hearsay, they have to give it to you within an hour of the time of arrest.
They have to give you within 2 hours of driving. So if your friend may have been out of the vehicle, may not have been driving during that time period, or they couldn't establish when they were driving. If they can't establish when the last driving occurred, then they can't establish that two-hour window, and they throw that blood test out or the breath test.
Mm.
That's exactly right. And we haven't gotten to that yet, but that's one of the defenses that we have. We always are really critical about when that officer or when the prosecutor can prove when you drove, because we have lots of no-drive cases where a person has not been driving.
Okay, that's all I need, sir.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
Hey, Mike. Thank you so much. Man, we're going to need about 2 hours here to go through all this. It's going to be cool. All right, you're listening to Haystack Help Radio. It's the Legal Hour. We're going to go through a lot more of this. And one thing real quick before the break, we want to make sure. This is not a show about how to get people off of a DUI or promoting drinking and driving and ways to get around it and all that. But you know what? You still have rights, Kevin. And that's what
you do.
Your job is all about. It's just protecting people's rights.
Yep, that's exactly right.
We'll be right back.
Ladies, I know you're tired of walking into the local gun store and seeing the same old thing. So let me tell you about Rampart Firearms. Just a quarter mile up Highway 67 off of Santa Fe and Sedalia, you will find a great selection of guns, ammo, tactical, and personal defense weapons. And if you or your spouse love to hunt, Rampart Firearms is a great stop for all of your hunting needs. Shotguns, rifles, pistols, anything from predator hunting to your next big game trip. Head to Rampart Firearms at the foot of the Rockies. Open 6 days a week, Monday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m., and you will only pay a 4% tax on your purchase. RampartFirearms.com, 720-468-0050. That's 720-468-0050.
Flesh and Beck are the attorneys you need after you've been injured due to the reckless actions of a drunk driver. Often victims of drunk driving accidents are forced to turn to their own insurance protection coverage to get their cars fixed and medical bills paid before receiving compensation, even though the drunk driver was at fault for the accident. When you are in an accident caused by someone who chose to drink and drive, unfortunately, getting the compensation you deserve isn't always as easy as you think. Insurance companies will bend over backwards to avoid a lawsuit, but only if they think they'll lose. And insurance companies know that if a lawsuit is leveled by a serious attorney and it goes to trial, the jury is allowed to decide on a monetary award for a sympathetic plaintiff who's been hit by a drunk driver. So a smaller injury settlement is in their best interest. Don't get taken advantage of. Don't settle for less than what you deserve. Call Flesh and Beck today at 303-806-8886 for the representation that will hold their feet to the fire and get you all the compensation that you deserve.
This is Steve Hurley with Affordable Interest Mortgage. I'm reaching out to you to help answer questions regarding the value of a reverse mortgage. You've heard both sides. I'm dedicated to helping seniors. The reason, like you, I am a senior and a veteran. Our wants and needs are different when compared to years past. Give me a call at 720-895-0500. Remember, take aim. Call me, Steve Hurley, at 720-895-0500. NMLS number 243200. Regulated by DORA, an equal opportunity lender.
Denver's Afternoon Rush. Rush to Reason is coming up at 3. Now, back to Haystack Help Radio.
We are back. You're listening to Haystack Help Radio. It's the Legal Hour with Kevin Flesh. Kevin's number, 303-806-8886. 303-806-8886. You can check out their website, fleshlawfirm.com. That's F-L-E-S-C-H, lawfirm.com. If you're just joining us, we're talking about DUIs. You know, this time of year, a lot of different home parties, holiday parties, a lot of different things, just people over, just you being at home and then thinking, oh, I need to go get something at the store. You never know. And you can put yourself in your harm's way pretty quick just being by yourself, Kevin.
Yes, and unfortunately you can. And you know, we see folks that are drinking by themselves that also have problems going to sleep. And I've had a number of these cases where they may have some alcohol and then take an Ambien just before going to bed. And they wake up in their driveway or somebody else's driveway or down the street in the landscaping, and they don't know how they got there. And those sorts of cases are really disturbing in the sense of the combination of the alcohol and the drugs, and that they just have gotten themselves in a place where, unfortunately, they were able to get to the keys of their car because they really can't remember anything until there's an officer that's like banging on the window of their car. And they didn't intentionally do it in the sense of knowingly knew that they were getting into their car with under the influence of these drugs or alcohol. But it's certainly something, again, where if you're getting into that sort of pattern of behavior, you want to make sure that you make it difficult for yourself to get to these keys so that you're not in your car.
And you were talking about with Mike real quick. You said not driving.
Yes.
And I want to explain that real quick.
Yeah.
You can get a DUI not driving.
Yeah, so yeah, you can. So, what people generally think of as driving. So it's going down the road. Mm-hmm. We have a number of cases a year. So this is the legal definition in Colorado is this, that you're behind the wheel of a car, that the keys are in the ignition, and you're capable of maneuvering that vehicle. You're capable of starting it, and that it'll run, and you have the present tense intention to drive. Okay, so where this runs into problems is you've stayed at a bar until bar time. You don't want to go home, but you have nowhere else to go. So you go to your car in the parking lot. You have no intention to go.
It's cold.
You turn on your car and you start your heater, and you're sitting in the driver's seat. You are now driving. You haven't left your parking spot. It can be snowing like crazy. The evidence is that you haven't driven for hours. You haven't actually had that vehicle moving for hours. You are driving, sitting in that parking lot. And an officer who may be going by and says, boy, that's weird. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. There's this one vehicle out in this parking lot. It hasn't been moved, but it's right now. It's running. They have the ability to come up to you and say, is everything okay? It's a safety concern. And then when you wake up from your stupor, realize you're impaired, you're now going to get charged with a DUI. And there's no exception to that. That's driving. But you haven't gone anywhere. I've also had them where were we just talking about with regard to, you know, you had no idea how you got in your car and drove down the road and ended up in somebody's landscaping. You don't know how that happened. They don't have to prove that you know or don't know how it happened. Mm-hmm. They just have to prove that you were behind the wheel and that the car was, you were driven it. So, I mean, those are really, really difficult cases. Mm-hmm. But the law doesn't actually establish that the prosecution has to prove what's called a mens rea, the knowingly drive. They just have to prove that you drove. And that, wow, that as long as they can prove that, then they can prove that element. Now, there are lots of situations where that doesn't happen, where you didn't drive or you're not. So people ask me about that. Well, what am I supposed to do if that's really the situation? That I don't have any idea. Lost my plan A. I've driven my vehicle to this location. I am now hammered. I can't drive. I realize that. I'm trying to do the right thing, but I've got to stay in the vehicle. I can't find any other way home. What do I do? And I'm going to freeze to death if I don't start the car. Well, don't be in the driver's seat. You can start the car. You can be in a passenger seat. You can be in the back seat. Just don't be in the driver's seat so that you've got a defense with, well, I was doing what I thought I was supposed to. If you're curled up in the back seat of a car while it's running, right, and you have no ability to run, you know, to drive the vehicle, you've got a really good drive defense. Mm-hmm. And or I've seen person has an RV, same thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
No, you know, you're in a parking lot at Walmart and you have some drinks and you're in an RV, make sure the keys are not in the ignition when you're sleeping in the back of the car. You can still be running things without the keys being in the ignition. That's a no-drive case, even though I've had a case recently where there was something else that was going on in the parking lot. My client got involved in a situation where they said he was harassing them, went back to his vehicle, clearly intoxicated. The officer said that he was driving because he was in his RV, but there was no proof that he'd actually moved the vehicle, so we were able to get the case dismissed. But it's one of those things where you don't want to be just leaving your keys in the ignition and being near the driver's seat because you can be making the argument that you're driving, sure, even though you have no intention to.
You mentioned a couple of times when you go before a jury. What percentage of these end up? Is that usually when there's an accident and someone's been hurt, or can a first-time DUI go to a jury?
Oh, yeah. First-time DUIs, it's a fairly small percentage of the cases that go. It's probably 10% or less of the cases that actually go to trial. But, I mean, so the reason that we do so much of this work is because we've seen so many different fact patterns, mm-hmm, that lend us to believe what we think we can prove or disprove relating to specific elements of the crimes when they're charged. So no driving is a big deal. How exactly? The things that we look at when we look at the case is, first of all, do we have reasonable suspicion? Does the officer have a reason to contact you to begin with? If there's an issue there, I'll give you an example. I had a client up in Fort Collins, went to a bar, got sideways with a bartender. She left. The bartender called it in to the police saying that she was under the influence. The bartender didn't give her the actual name of who that person was. So it's basically an anonymous tip at that point.
Gotcha.
So the police officers in the area were looking for this particular car and looking for a female occupant. They saw her and the car at a gas station. She was pumping gas. She got gas. She drove out of the gas station, and the police immediately pulled her over. Well, what's she done wrong? She hasn't done anything wrong. So they have a ready report, an anonymous ready report of a potentially intoxicated driver. But the police didn't have any indication that she had done anything illegal. And they had an anonymous tip, so they can't actually go back and find out who it was that said she was under the influence. We filed a motion in that case to say, you got to have a reason to pull her over. You got to have a violation of the law, or you have to have a credible person that can come in to a motions hearing and say, yeah, I saw her. I served her 18 drinks. She was blotto drunk when she left, and they didn't have either of those things. The court had to throw the case out. that's an example of how we can help people in that she may have been impaired, but the process wasn't done properly, so we were able to later get the case dismissed. And those are the sorts of things we look at. So we looked at reasonable suspicion. We then look at, do we have a drive case? Do we have a situation where they can't prove that you were impaired while you were driving? We've had those cases where someone gets into an accident in their neighborhood. They come home. They're really upset about it because they just ran from an accident. They shouldn't have done that, but they did it. They park their car in the garage, and they're completely sober when they come home. But then they start drinking. Mm-hmm. The officers show up an hour later. The person's hammered. Person's intoxicated. Well, at that point, the officers charge them with the DUI because they're going to make the leap that they were intoxicated at the time. That's why they left the accident scene. But they can't prove it. It's another one of those cases where we can prove with witness testimony, person was sober, came home, had a bunch of drinks, and you can't charge the person with DUI. So those are the sorts of, it's individual fact patterns that we have to look at to make determinations about how, again, you should have a plan, you shouldn't get into these things, but when you do, then we have the obligation to make sure that we do everything we can to make sure that the process is fair.
Right. And you know, probably the smartest thing that she did, the young lady you're talking about, drove poor guy, is hiring a DUI attorney.
Right.
Here's what. You go get your family law attorney friend, get out of that. I guarantee you that probably wouldn't have had the ending you did.
Right. And what was interesting about that particular case is, quite frankly, if the DA had done some work and gone back to the bar to figure out who the bartender was, they probably could have worked the case enough to get past the motions issue that we raised. They did, but they were lazy. They just didn't do it. And so in that particular case, I was waiting and I was expecting to have the bartender show up for that motions hearing. But when that person didn't show up at the motions hearing, I had a case that was directly on point that said you can't use anonymous tips to then allow an officer to pull the person over, that the officer has to see some sort of indicia of some sort of law violation before they pull over the vehicle.
We're gonna skip this last break, Charlie, because I want to get some other information out here. But
yeah,
let's talk about the DMV side of this. Okay, yeah. So you get your DUI. First thing. Once you get out, I guess, call you.
Right.
This isn't like or is it like TV? Hey, you're going to get your call when you get to jail, and that's where I call you, somebody calls you from, or just call when you get out.
Yeah.
What's the best thing?
So normally, about half the time you are given a summons to appear and you get out, you just have to call somebody to come and pick you up because they don't allow you to drive. Normally, your vehicle's not at the station anyway. So you got to call somebody to come and pick you up. So the next day or the next 2 days later, within 48 hours, you want to be in contact with our office to move forward with getting representation. But the bigger issue short term is the DMV consequences, because this is where everybody gets confused. So when you leave jail, or when you leave the detox center, or you leave wherever they've taken you, you'll be given a summons and complaint to show up for court, for criminal court. Okay. So that's in the county wherever this happened. That's easy. That's normally 65 days down the road. You've got time to worry about that. The other thing that you'll have, though, is an express consent affidavit. It'll be a yellow sheet of paper that talks about what the officer saw in the way of indicia of alcohol, what you did for voluntary roadside maneuvers, and if you took a test, a breath test in particular, they'll say right in there what the blood alcohol level was for you, and they will say that they've taken your driver's license. If you have one of those forms and you know that you took a breath test and you don't have your driver's license, you have to go to the DMV within 7 days of the arrest to request a hearing. That yellow form will be your driver's license until you go to the DMV to get. If you don't do that, then you lose your license right away. First offense, you lose your license for 90 days. Okay. It's 90 days. It's 9 months. For the first offense.
Okay.
The issue with the first offense is that you can get early reinstated after 30 days of no driving.
Okay.
So that's if you don't make any requests for a hearing. We always tell people to go make a request for hearing because, number one, you prolong the necessary time. They continue to give you a temporary license until that hearing, and then you'll want to request that the officer be present because about 20-25% of the time the officers don't show up. And if they don't show up, then you get your driver's license back. The other 70-80% of the time, we're able to cross-examine the officers and find out if we can find holes in what they did. to see if we can then get your license back for some sort of legal reason. But that hearing is helpful at the beginning. It gives you some time to figure out what you're going to do about your driving when you lose it, because the majority of the people do lose their driving privilege. First offense, you lose it for that 9-month period. You really only lose it for 30 days because you can get the interlock put in your car during that time period, and then you have the interlock for the rest of that it's really 8 months on a first offense. Now, if you have a high BAC, anything over 0.15, which is almost double the legal limit, you then have to have an interlock device in your car for 2 years once you early reinstate. Or if you wait that 9-month period, let's say you wait the 9 months, you say, you know what, I don't need my driving privilege for that 9-month period. I just don't want to deal with the interlock. Unfortunately, if you're a persistent drunk driver, if you're at that 0.15 or higher, you're going to have an interlock in your car for 2 years, no matter when you start it.
Okay.
And there's no getting around it. And people are like, well, that doesn't seem fair. And I always tell them, that's your opinion. You need to go to the legislature and change it, because they're the ones that made this regulation. Mm-hmm. It's all politically based, and they've decided that's what it is. And there's no discretion upon the hearing officers for DMV. That's if you're above that 0.15. If you're below, if you're in that 0.08 or 0.08 to 0.15, then you've just got that period of time in the first offense. It's 8 months. It can be less if you don't have any problems with the interlock in the first 4 months. They sometimes will take it out. If it's a second offense or longer, you'll have to have it in for longer. Just depends on how many.
A couple initials I want to go over here. And like I say, we could do several shows on this. But, of course, you got your DUI, DWI, OUI. So talk just a couple of and the differences.
Yes. And the DUID. It's just all kinds of acronyms. So driving under the influence, the legal definition of that is that you're substantially incapable of driving a vehicle. That's the DUI. That's the big 12-point offense. You lose your license on points. You lose your license because of the offense itself. Those are the ones that are more difficult to prove from the prosecution's point of view. Alcohol-wise, you have to be over 0.08 or higher, or you have to show that you're substantially incapable. So if you get out of your car and you fall, you can't stand up straight, right? And even if you refuse, you could still be charged and convicted of a DUI. Right? The DWAI is driving while ability impaired, and impaired to a slightest degree. So that's what a lot of jurors do if they know that you have some sort of alcohol or drugs in your system, but they don't know if it's substantially incapable. They fall back on the to the slightest degree. Now, to the slightest degree with alcohol means anything BAC-wise, blood alcohol content-wise, of 0.05 to 0.08. So most people, you're a couple hundred pounds, you're in your 40s, you go out to dinner, you have a half a bottle of wine with your significant other, and you drive home, you're real close to that 0.05 when you do that. Depending upon if you have a drink before or after dinner, and depending upon how long a period of time that you've been drinking the alcohol, you may be real close to the legal limit when you leave the restaurant. That's something that people have to consider when they go out in those sorts of events. But it's a low standard. Slightest degree is really difficult to defend, because most jurors, if they know that you've had alcohol in your system and they've got some voluntary roadside maneuvers that you did that you thought you'd be able to get out of, and it shows that you have some impairment when you would have it sober or otherwise, you're probably getting convicted of that. And then both can be with drugs. So the DUID is a drug component. And it includes any prescription drugs, legal drugs, illegal drugs, and they'll run, in those cases where they believe that you're impaired by some sort of drug, you'll almost always be asked to do a blood test, and then there's different types of blood tests that the amount of different drugs that they check for.
Right. About 2 minutes left here, real quick. When you're asked, hey, can we search your car?
Never. No. The simple answer is no. And the reason that you do that is because you have some privacy rights within your vehicle, and they're asking you that so that they don't have to go get a search warrant from a judge, which takes a long time, and they have to have real probable cause. And if someone is asking you to search your vehicle, they have a hunch that there's something in the vehicle that will help them in prosecuting you for a crime. So you never allow them to do it, even if you think, oh, not a big deal. There's nothing here. You just never know. You don't know I had a case a few years ago where my client was certain that there wasn't anything in his car, and so he allowed them to check it, except he had forgotten his son had left a handgun underneath the passenger seat by mistake when they had gone shooting a week or two earlier. And in the course of him getting a DUI, now he's being charged with the weapon violation because he's impaired and he has a weapon in the car. So you just don't allow it to happen. Let them go get a search warrant if they think they have probable cause for a search warrant. There's no exigent circumstances where they have your vehicle towed or whatever. There's no reason that they can look at it at that point. And most likely they won't have a judge sign a search warrant unless there's something else going on. And if there's something else going on, you probably know about it. And in those situations, again, you don't want them searching the vehicle.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well, again, if you joined us late, we want to make very, very clear this show has not been about getting you off of DUIs. We're just trying to give you some education on what it means, the process, the cost, and everyone still has rights when you make a mistake.
That's right. And that's the biggest thing. And that it's not that the people that get themselves charged with these crimes are bad people, because the majority of them are not. You've made a mistake. It's how you respond to that mistake that it's the most important things. And a lot of times what I find with people in the first, we do free consultations for these sorts of things. I like to have a conversation with the people as to how they got themselves into this situation. What's going on in their life? It's normally an indication that something else is out of control in their life and that they need help with that. And we also try to solve that problem for them so that they don't have another one of these come up down the road. And if it's folks that they're on their third or fourth or fifth conviction, or they're coming up on that, then we want to figure out why this is happening to help them, because it's clearly not a functional lifestyle for them.
Sure.
And that's, people need help with that too.
Absolutely. Kevin, great information. Thank you.
You're welcome.
303-806-8886. 303-806-8886. FleshLawFirm.com. Flesh and Beck Law. Thank you for joining us today for Haystack Help Radio. Hope you have a great rest of your day. Leave it right here on KLZ 560.
And opinions expressed on KLZ 560 are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of Crawford Broadcasting, the station, management, employees, associates, or advertisers. KLZ 560 is a Crawford Broadcasting God and Country station.